So thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here at this conference, and thanks for coming. So Friday morning. So I guess this is probably the only. Oops, what is that noise? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Is that better? Yeah. So this is, I think, the only talk on the cuprate superconductors in this conference. So I'm assuming that I'm speaking to an audience of people who are not entirely familiar with much of the recent experiments. And what I'm going to do is talk about some ideas that we're working on right now, which developed over a series of work in the last couple of years, especially in collaboration more recently with Yu-Wu Kao, who's now here at the KITP, and Shen-Ke Zhu, who's a junior fellow at Harvard, and a very recent collaboration with Victor Galitsky at Maryland. So one of my main messages is that, you know, the cuprates have been around for a long time, nearly, I guess, over 20 years now. But it is still true, what keeps the fields exciting and fresh, in my opinion, is that there have been, in the past year or so, a number of remarkable new experiments, and in fact, a few experimental surprises. So at this point, I think, you know, the essential data that needs to be explained is very clearly out there. There's still a number of experiments we can imagine that will be done in the future, but I think a lot has been learned from the experiments in the last couple of years. So one of the things I'm going to do is just review some of these experiments and then give you our perspective on one way of understanding them, at least part, some aspects of them. There's still a long way from any complete theory of especially the underdoped region of the cuprates. So let me just begin with a survey of some of recent experiments. So this is the familiar phase diagram, of course. We have a whole series of cuprates, which as a function of hole concentration and also electron concentration in some cases, go from an antiferromagnetic insulator to a D-wave superconducting state. And if you look at the normal state spectrum in photo emission, then in the so-called overdoped regime, where the hole doping is large, then you see a beautiful large, so-called large Fermi surface. And this is called a large Fermi surface because it's what band structure would predict without any sort of ordering. And it has a volume, or encloses an area more precisely, which is given by the Luttender theorem. So the volume of the holes is 1 plus p. I guess the holes are inside this big surface. Unfortunately, sometimes, you know, here's zero zeros at this point, and occasionally you'll see plots with zero zero at this point, and hopefully it'll be clear from the context. On the other hand, if you, at least in the whole dope cuprates, if you underdope, then even well before you see any antiferromagnetic order, there seems to be this breaking up of the Fermi surface. You get what look like hole pockets, which are can be naturally understood once you have antiferromagnetic long-range order, but there certainly seem to be some other type of, some precursors of the antiferromagnetism or possibly some other order that's leading to the formation of these pockets. But nevertheless, this is at finite temperature, and really the issue is to understand carefully what happens at very low temperatures when the Fermi surface topology is strongly constrained by various Luttender theorems, and and the questions between different phases becomes much sharper. The distinction between different phases becomes much sharper. Okay, so certainly, however, when you're here in the overdoped regime, if you now go to lower temperature, you get superconductivity, and you get a pairing gap, which as you go around the Fermi surface, so now zero zero is here. I'm sorry, I've shifted it by pi pi. So here's the same Fermi surface. So this arc here is the same as that arc over there. So along that arc, you have a pairing amplitude, which fits conventional D waveform very well. And so this is, you know, well understood and seemingly convincing evidence for conventional BCS D wave superconductor. On the other hand, the mysteries start when you look at the same kind of data, but at low doping. So in particular, this is tunneling data. You already start seeing at this high temperature a gap developing in tunneling. And if you resolve this gap in momentum space, what you see in photo emission data, some of it fairly recent, that the gap is almost entirely in the so-called antinodal regions, where the D-wave gap has a maximum. And so the gap structure at this high temperature looks like this. And there's no gap at all. It's sort of a Fermi arc, so-called arc developing, a highly unusual feature, in along the diagonals of the Brillouin zones. And then only when you lower the temperature and go into superconducting state and you're not too very low in doping, then the gap fills in the nodal region. At least that was the picture a couple of years ago. Now there have been further experiments trying to look, even at smaller p, precisely this development of the gap in the nodal and the antinodal regions. There's been a number of experiments, and different experimentalists have emphasis on different aspects. But the basic thing that emerges, for example, in this STM experiment, these are these, you know, deduced from Fourier transform of the LDOS modulation by Seamus Davis's group. So here you've seen that this, the same gap along this angle theta is again this angle here around the Fermi surface. And what you see in the, for a very underdoped material, you see the sharp development of a gap when you go to the antinodal region, and almost a flat ungapped region along the diagonals. And this becomes, but as you go to near optimal doping, you develop then this conventional D wave gap that BCS theory would give you. Sorry? That's right. So, well, so this is just zero. So obviously things can't go below zero. So that's the assumption is that they are all zero energy. Yeah, these are shifted. Sorry. Yeah, so there are missing data points over here for sure, but here there aren't, I guess. I'm here. Yeah. So this is, you know, this is because of the particular probe. There are similar data. Well, photo emission hasn't quite shown this flat region. So there's this recent data of Kaminsky in Nature. I'm summarizing. I mean, I would take a whole talk to show all the data. So this is their very nice summary of what goes on in their interpretation for the emission. So if you look at the spectral gap in the what they call the pseudo gap, then as you underdope, it seems to go up, as shown here. On the other hand, if you look at the coherent quasi-particle peak, which is predominantly near the nodal point, it seems to go down, and you get at very low temperature, a seeming development of a Fermi arc. Okay, so what's precisely going on in all of these different experiments is, you know, not entirely clear, but this whole phenomenon has been summarized by what's called the nodal antinodal dichotomy. That there's at least the physics near pi zero, and where the Mach gap is a maximum, seems to be very, very different than the physics along where you get the node in the gap, both in the temperature and the doping dependence of this energy scale. So here there's a nice paper by George Sawatsky and collaborators recently where they summarized, you know, tons of data from many, many probes who have taken over several years. And so where they look at gap, at energy scale characterizing the nodal excitations, like the velocity of those nodal excitations or the superfluid density, you get an energy scale that vanishes as you go down to low doping. And if you look at the scale near pi zero, although sometimes called the pseudo gap, that seems to continue to increase. And this kind of picture is often sometimes quoted as evidence for, well, there's a superconducting gap, and this gap is really due to some other physics or some competing order developing. You know, I subscribe to that picture somewhat, but I'm going to try to present a theory which where I focus right now on just trying to develop this differentiation in momentum space between these two regions. Okay, so there is in fact a paper that anticipated some of this due to Geschkin, Banioffi, and Larkin a decade ago. And so it was a phenomenological model which they said that, well, here's the same Fermi surface again that I showed you now, again with 0, 0 at the center. These are the occupied states, and these are the whole empty states. Have I got that right? Yeah. And what they said was, let's assume there's very strong pairing of the electrons sitting over here. So and so you just cut off that portion of the Fermi surface and represent those electrons in this region of the Fermi, of the Brillouin zone, by a boson. So they pair very strongly and form a boson. And that boson could, they assume, go superfluid. It could also crystallize into some kind of regional crystal. It has essentially a dispersion that's a heavy, it's a very massive boson, which they call B. And then they say, well, there are these portions of the Fermi surface, these Fermi arcs that survive, and the coupling between the boson and these fermions is this proximity coupling, which has this D-wave signature. So this VPQ vanishes along the diagonal. So so this is just a model written down by hand, which differentiates by hand the different regions of the momentum of the Brillouin zone, and has this boson-fermion coupling between boson representing these fermions and these Cs being the fermions along these arcs. So so this was put forward as a phenomenological model, and in fact it leads to some rather nice explanation of the Hall conductivity data that we're focusing on, which I'll show very briefly later on in YBCO. But there are many mysterious aspects to this. It's not at all clear whether it makes sense to talk about Fermi arcs, which just end into nothing. And why should we just put in these bosons just in those regions of the Brillouin zone? And why should you have this D-wave signature? All of these things are just not at all clear where they're coming from in this picture. So I'm going to present some ideas where many of these features are going to appear from a semi-microscopic model, but also many differences. And we'll see that you can get models like this, but only in gauge theory. So they have to have the additional collective gauge mode that allow you to do things like violate Luttinger theorem. Okay, so that's a survey of some of the experiments I'm going to show. So that's some further experiment very shortly. But before I get there, let me just now review the spin density wave theory of antiferromagnetism in a metallic state of the type you see at the large doping superconductors. So if we start again with this Fermi surface at large doping, that's clearly seen in experiments. Again, now it's the zero zeros at the center, not over here. And then you add in, for now, commensurate pi-pi antiferromagnetism. So the way you do that in the spin density wave theory is you take this Fermi surface and shift it by pi-pi. So you get this circular shape, which is the data I showed you at the very beginning. So the fermions on this Fermi surface will now couple to the fermions on the other Fermi surface because of they're shifted by pi-pi and there's a spin density wave order at that wave vector. And so you're going to open up gaps like this. So you get a state where you would have, in blue, what's called an electron pocket. So you have electrons sitting in this region of the Brillouin zone and a hole pocket along the diagonal. And in fact, this type of structure here, if you may have noticed, I'm talking about the electron-doped cuprates. There are millions of cuprates to which not as much attention has been paid, where this structure of the Fermi surface is basically seen right here. So at moderate doping, you've got the beginnings of a hole pocket here and the beginnings of an electron pocket here. And now zero zero is over there. So, okay. It's just shifted in different ways, but this Fermi surface structure is some evidence in the electron doped cuprates of both electron and hole pockets. And of course, at very low doping, you get, in this case, only electron pockets, and that's also seen right here in the electron doped cuprate. So at least in the electron doped cuprate, this weak coupling spin density wave picture seems to be reasonable, seems to fit photoemission. And also, there's a number of works trying to fit the Hall data. When the pockets open and close, there are changes in the Hall resistance, and that seems to fit very well. And recently, with Andres Harkov, we've looking at the Nernst effect on the electron doped cuprates. And again, this model seems to explain the data really very cleanly. So the spin density wave, somewhat boring, but still quite interesting picture, at least for the norm of the normal state property, is quite successful for the electron doped cuprates. But so far, for the cold doped situation, remains still open. Okay, so if you do the same strategy for the hold doped cuprates, then you would see again, you start with the big Fermi surface, you shift it by pi-pi, you get electron hole pockets, and then finally, at very low doping, you're going to get these only hole pockets now, or with very strong spin density wave order. And so, whoops. Huh? My telephone? No. It's not my phone, sorry. Don't accuse me of such things. Okay, well, anyway, is it okay now? All right. So in the, you can still hear me? Yeah. So in the hold of kuprates, then you go from this large Fermi surface to this whole pocket state. And I showed you at the very beginning of my talk, this is actually photo emission data of what looked like this whole pocket state and this large Fermi surface. And you know, that data has been around for a while, and so there has been a lot of work, including by me and my collaborators, on trying to think about pairing in this whole pocket state. And somewhat different work, say, starting from work of Pines and Scalapino, of talking about D-wave superconductivity from this state. Anyway, so that's been, you know, the focus of sort of two different camps over the last decade or so. And in this context, there's some recent experiment, before I get there, and similar pictures also appear, for example, in YBCO when you take incommensurate order. But of course, the details become quite complicated. Anyway, so the surprise recently, really the, I think the breakthrough experiment, has been the observation of quantum oscillations in the holdope cuprates in the underdope regime, in particular in YBCO, by initial experiment by Louis Taillefer, and now there's been a whole host of similar experiments by several groups. And so what they see is are these oscillations, in fact, this is the Hall resistance, as a function of magnetic field. And these, okay, and this data is not entirely convincing, but they look periodic in 1 over V. Now there's much better data, which shows this periodic oscillations to up to 10 periods. So there's really no doubt that you've got oscillations that are periodic in 1 over V. And these are essentially so-called Subnikov-Dehaas, or, the Subnikov-Dehaas oscillations. And they're associated, roughly speaking, since this is a quantum Hall gang, with filling Landau levels. So you. This is, you know, you've got, as you're increasing B, here you've got 300 Landau levels, 299, something. There's several hundred Landau levels that are being filled, but as you go through the Landau levels, you see oscillations in the resistance. So you can also read off from the period in 1 over B, the carrier density that's associated with these oscillations. And the carrier density comes out to be a bit of a surprise. It's not 1 plus P, which is what you'd expect, for a big hole Fermi surface, but it's around P, or not even quite P, this is a doping of around 0.1, and you get a carrier density of 0.076. So that was the first surprise in this low-dope PC superconductor with no obvious magnetic order or any other order of the type other than superconductivity, at least at zero field. In a field of, I should say, these are experiments at 60 Tesla, so these are very state-of-the-art. And the cleanest crystals we have. So this is a beautiful experiment. So that's one surprise, that you have this small period and the small density. And the second surprise, which is not as well accepted, but I'm going to take it as a starting point for our theory, is that the small period is associated, the small density is associated with an electron pocket. And the main evidence for that is just this negative Hall coefficient that develops at large field, where you're seeing these are the oscillations that I showed you. So they've done a systematic analysis of this as a function of field and temperature. And again, the group of Taillefer has argued that the only sensible explanation of this data is that there are electron pockets in the holdope cuprates in these high magnetic fields. So that's a pretty strong claim and not universally accepted, especially the electron pocket at this point. The fact that it's a pocket of fermions, I think, is becoming quite convincing, and its other explanations are really not tenable, in my opinion. The electron, the fact that it's electron-like and not hole-like is still up for debate, but I'm going to take it as a given for the theory I'm going to present. In fact, the only theory that had talked about electron pockets in the holdup cuprates was this spin density wave. Well, I should say not the only one, you know, the earliest theories. Was the work of Chubukov and Moore, where they were thinking about the spin density wave theory in the whole of cuprates. And when you go from the large to the small Fermi surface, there's always an intermediate state where you do have an electron pocket. It's not been seen in photo emission, but so how come it appears in these quantum oscillations? So we're going to offer kind of, there's two differences. First of all, photo emission is at very high field. It's done at zero field, so maybe the electron pocket's only a feature of the high field region. And secondly, I'm sorry, these are the electron pockets, forgive me. These are the hole pockets, the electron pockets up here, so in red. And secondly, I'm going to argue, showing the picture of Geskin-Bahn, Yoffe, and Larkin, that in fact the electron pockets are there, but they are strongly paired, and that's why they won't show up in photo emission. But once you break the pairs in high field, they do show up in the quantum oscillations. Okay, so any questions on like the survey of the experiment so far and some of the simple spin density wave theories before I launch into our work? which experiments? Those are very low temperature. I think they're 4 Kelvin or something like that. Oops, I'm going the wrong way. Yeah, so there are also measurements of the temperature dependence of the oscillation, and they disappear at a few Kelvin. And the temperature prefactor seems to agree with the Lipschitz-Kosovich expression, and from that they can read off an effective mass and so on, and a scattering time. And they get an effective mass of a few electron masses. So it seems quite reasonable in that this is really a quantum oscillation off of Fermi surface. Yeah, the pockets. You mean pockets in transport, high field transport. Yeah, they're about the same. So, yes, so that's the reason why this R plus these Fermi are. So immediately when these first appeared, the interpretation, including in a paper by us, was that these oscillations have to do with the Fermi arc, which are really associated with the whole light region. But then Taillefer quickly, came up with a second nature paper where he argued that really it should be due to an electron light region. And I'm going to assume he's correct, all of these people, and try to develop a theory of the fluctuating antiferromagnetism in the presence of both electron and hole pockets. So just to remind you again, in this spin density wave picture, there's, as you can see, the spin density, these are the hole pockets, and the Fermi arc is referring to is this region of the Fermi surface that's seen in photo emission. Photo emission doesn't see any signature of this pocket. But the photo emission is not at 60 Tesla, so that could be an obvious explanation. All right, so then let's get to our theory. So it's going to be based upon a somewhat exotic state that we call an algebraic charged liquid, but it's not that I'm going to propose that state has been seen in the experiments. It could be in some future experiment, but it's a very useful state from which to start and look at various instabilities. And almost one of those instabilities invariably occurs, but it gives you a rather different picture of the superconducting state than starting from the large Fermi surface state, which is what Pines and Scalapino would do, for example. So the physics of what I'm going to talk about is not that different from the spin fluctuation mediated mechanism of Pines and Scalapino, but I'm not going to start from the large Fermi surface state. I'm going to start from a small Fermi surface state, and we'll see what develops. So the idea is that I'm going to start, rather than starting from here and putting in spin fluctuations, I'm going to start from this state. And the picture, you see the original picture here, you see this Fermi surface evolution in a model where you have some spin density wave order whose amplitude slowly increases. So we just do Hartree-Fock theory with increasing spin density wave order, you see this Fermi surface evolution. What I'm going to do, colloquially speaking, is start from this state, but allow the spin density wave order to be present in at least locally in magnitude, so that locally there's Fermi surfaces forming which have this local pocket structure, but then allow its orientation to fluctuate. And it's mainly those orientational fluctuation that will then lead to the loss of antiferromagnetism and also fluctuations that can lead to pairing. So that whole formulation is much more convenient when you take your spin density wave vector and write it in terms of a spinner, because you want to keep track of the electron variables at these pockets. And it's much easier, electrons are spinners, so that's much easier to do it using the spinner coordinates. So the idea is, I'm going to look at fluctuations of these electron hole pockets. So let's focus on this pocket here. It's an electron pocket. And so I have the electron field, which I'll call C1, up and down at that pocket. And I'll just write it as G plus and minus for a spin density wave order that points, say, in the up direction. So this is the physical spin label, and plus and minus at the moment are the same as a spin label, but pretty soon will become a charge, a sublattice label. But now I take the spin density wave order and allow it to fluctuate in an arbitrary direction. And clearly what that means is I just have to put an SU2 rotation on this G plus G minus. So I've taken my physical spin density, my physical electron operator, and written it as a product of a rotating reference frame that brings me, you know, to the local orientation of the spin density wave order at each point, times the up and down electrons in that local rotating reference frame. Now you'll notice when I do this that I immediately introduce a gauge redundancy. I can G plus, the plus and minus are actually the charges on the gauge redundancy. The G plus carries a plus charge, it carries a minus charge, and the Z carries charge one. And that gauge that immediately leads to gauge forces, as we know. That will be crucial for everything I'm going to say. Now, the advantage, one important feature of this formalism is now I can take the electron operator here, and it also is represented in terms of the G plus and G minus, but with this minus sign. And it's simply because for a spin density wave, the up electrons see a potential that's the negative of the down electron. So these orbitals are symmetric combinations of the underlying electronic orbitals. The up are symmetric combinations, the down are anti-symmetric combinations. So that's where the minus sign comes from. And so now I can do a rotation for the two electrons also with the same SU2 matrix. So now I have introduced my degrees of freedom describing the orientational fluctuation of the electron pockets. And I can write down a theory for them. There's a theory for the Z fluctuation, which will be the CP1 model. It's basically the simplest theory you write down, consistent with spin rotation invariance and this gauge redundancy, U1 gauge redundancy that I introduced. And similarly, for the G plus and G minus, I can also write down a gauge theory. So I get a Fermi surface of these electron pockets, which are the G plus and a G minus, which are also coupled to the same U1 gauge force. And there are a number of other kind of not so important terms, but this is the basic model that we're going to take. We have a coupling T here, which is going to tune you from the strongly fluctuating spin density wave state at large T to this ordered state at small T. So as a function of that coupling, I can try to at least in this guess an initial normal state phase diagram, which will look something like this. So T is something like delta. And so at small t, as I said, you have the Z's condensed. So that's simply saying that you have spin density wave order. And that's just the conventional non-fluctuating state I started with. 5 minutes left. Oh, my gosh. OK. and then I, at large t, I have this what I call an algebraic charge liquid, which is a non-Fermi liquid phase, which the pockets survive of the G's, but because the G's and the Z's are, the G's are not the electrons, they have to be convoluted with the Z's to get an electron operator, you will see some evidence of those pockets in this state without long-range order, but that's why we call them ghost pockets. And this may be a possible state anyway for describing the finite temperature region. Anyway, let me not talk about that. So finally, it's running out of time. Now we have to also look at the forces between the G plus and G minus. So I have to go back here quickly. I have these fermions, G plus and G minus, coupled to the gauge field with opposite charges. So there's an attractive force between them. And quite relevant for this conference, this kind of model of fermions with two Fermi surfaces coupled together with an attractive gauge force is in fact a model that was considered for the double-layer quantum Hall system that Jim Eisenstein spoke about earlier, where you have two nu equals 1/2 quantum Hall states. So there's an anti-symmetric gauge field, which is the most singular long low energies. If you end up a model, at least at this level, which looks very similar to what we're interested in fact was studied by these people in the context of the quantum Hall effect. So we can borrow their results, and one of their main results was that this kind of system is very strongly unstable to pairing. So what's happening is the gauge forces have two effects. There's an attractive gauge force that wants to pair the fermions, but there's also a pair breaking effect because the gauge forces lead to the loss of the coherent quasiparticles. They can also be strongly pair breaking. But in this case, for S-wave pairing, there's a kind of an exact cancellation of the pair breaking and the attraction force at low frequencies, whereas the attraction limits at higher frequency. And so you do get very strong pairing at an energy scale of order the Fermi energy. And it's S-wave pairing. So you get G plus G minus form a constant S-wave state. Now you might say, well, that's not what you want, but in fact, that's exactly what you want. If you now just go back to the physical electron operators. So remember, the physical electron will rotate by the SU2 matrix. So I've paired the G's now, and then I work out the pairing of the C's, the physical electrons, and I get this minus sign. So the pairing in this direction is the negative of the pairing of that pocket, and that's entirely due to this minus sign associated with antiferromagnetism. So it's the antiferromagnetism at near pi, which is what's responsible for the D-wave signature. This is a version of the original Fine-Scalfino argument in a very different language using the spinor variable. Okay, so once you have pairing, and then you can change the phase diagram a little bit, so I'm going to rush, I'm sorry. You have to allow for pairing now as a function of doping and magnetic field. And this is now, the whole phase diagram is based upon some earlier work with Demler, where we at the phenomenological level looked at the competition between spin density wave and superconductivity. What I've shown you is that in this region is unstable to B-wave superconductor. And then if you apply a magnetic field, however, that's a zero magnetic field, but if you apply a magnetic field, you suppress the D-wave superconductivity and that enhances the spin density wave order. And there have been a number of experiments that have tested this phase diagram in the last few years. Originally, there was the Lake et al. Enhancement of spin density wave and lanthanum strontium copper oxide there. But more recently, there's been experiments on this side of this quantum critical point, including seeing this transition that we predicted from the D-wave superconductor to spin density wave order. And there's a very recent preprint just a few weeks ago by Keimer seeing the same transition in YBCO. And the quantum oscillation experiments are in this region. And in fact, both of these phases will exhibit quantum oscillations without any Zeeman splitting, which is again seems to be another feature of the observed oscillation. So this picture does seem to fit in very nicely. This is where you see the electron pockets. If you're lucky, this phase might be seen. The characteristic of this phase is that you have no long-range order, but you still have pockets. It would give you quantum oscillations, but with a slightly modified temperature dependence. But that's not clear. Okay, 1 minute left, so we can try to skip the numerical estimates. The other main point I want to make is how about the holes? What happens to the holes? Well, so I've talked about the G, which are the electrons. What about the holes? Well, you can do a very similar theory. Of course, the holes will also couple to the same gauge field. Now, you'll say this is bad news. This means the holes will want to form an S-wave paired state. But, and there is also a coupling due to Geschenbein, Yaffe, and Larkin, with kind of a proximity coupling, which takes a pair of electrons and converts them to a pair of holes. And in our theory, we can actually just work out the form of this coupling just by symmetry, just from all the symmetry transformations and the gauge invariance of the theory. There's a unique low-energy form, and this is a unique low-energy term, and it has exactly the right, the gradient, it vanishes along the zone diagonals, and it has a D-wave signature for the Fs. In fact, if you look from here, if you pair the Gs, you get a pairing of the Fs, which has this momentum dependence, which kind of looks P-wave. But that's also very natural, because if you have a global D-wave pairing, you see that this pocket has a P-wave pairing, plus two minus. And for this P-wave pairing, the gauge fluctuations are very detrimental. So that's the bottom line, that the strong gauge fluctuations don't destroy the pairing here, but they do disrupt the pairing here very strongly. And that's why we claim there's a dichotomy between the nodal and the antinodal region. That's the main message I have for my talk. So there it is. And so summarize, what the starting point of this theory was a theory for the laws of spin density wave order, which is not the conventional Hertz theory, but a theory based upon fluctuation of the spin of variable. But we're starting from a weakly coupled spin density wave, though. It's a kind of an intermediate coupling theory. And I showed you that really, without many further assumptions, you get very naturally some features that I'm quite excited about, that is strong pairing at the antinodes and weak pairing at the nodes, because of the way the gauge fluctuations act very differently on these two states. And there's this new state, which I don't think has been seen in any current experiments, but hopefully maybe someday will be, some characteristics of it may be seen. This is a new non-Fermi liquid state, but all the present phases that we see in experiments appear very naturally as instabilities of this state. Thank you. No, in fact, in weak coupling, I mean, by competition, you mean if you suppress the superconductivity, you're going to enhance the antiferromagnetism. So that's a function of a quartic term between them. So you're talking about, you know, you have your favorite auto parameter. So this is a superconductivity, and then it's got some pairing susceptibility, and you compute this graph. Or you have antiferromagnetism. And then you compute this graph and you get a susceptibility. That's the quadratic level. To see this competition, you have to go to next order. You have to look at graphs like this. Can you see what I'm writing? Maybe I'll come on this side. You have to look at quartic graphs like this. Oops, sorry. You have a fermion loop here, and you have, say, superconductivity here and antiferromagnetism here. So this will tell you when both orders are present, do they like to be present together, or are they like oil and water? Well, if you do this calculation weak coupling, they in fact are attractive. I think the computation is not as obvious. In my earlier work with Eugene Demler, we just assumed there was computation on a phenomenological level. But this theory does give you a repulsive sign for that term. We are working on them, yes. So one of the predictions is that the Lipschitz-Kosovich factor, prefactor of the quantum oscillation will be modified. So we have computed that at high temperature in the semi-classical regime with corrections to the Lipschitz-Kosovich term. We're still trying to work it out at very low temperatures. But that's kind of a subtle detail. I mean, ideally, the main prediction is you see quantum oscillation of a pocket, what you don't see at the same time, a neutron scattering long-range order. So if that's the case, then I think this is the only possibility, this phase that we've talked about. But we can't do neutron scattering so easily at 60 Tesla. So that's why we have to then look at some subtle signatures like in the prefactor, and we're trying to compute those. That's an excellent question. Probably, the superconducting state, yes. But the normal state, not. And so the superconducting state, one detail I didn't discuss, once you go superconducting, then actually the monopoles that I briefly mentioned, they condense and the whole thing goes into a confining state, which we've analyzed. And that will be smoothly connected to the strong coupling state. But another interesting question is, can you have a possible critical point or phase transition between the pocket state and the large Fermi surface state in the normal state directly? I have no idea. I don't have a theory for that for sure. But in the superconducting state, it's smoothly connected. Right. So that's related to my question here. Right. So we are really talking about the physics of the underdoped. I mean, I thought about that question, of course, a lot, and we just said, let's just focus on the underdoped region and let's just believe the electron particles. and this is what comes out. So I think we do, I claim we understand some aspects of the underworld regime quite easily in much more natural manner than I've seen before. And really the key open problem is to figure out how to connect this to the overworld side. I have not addressed that at all.